This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Welcome to Positive Parenting on the American Forces Network on this Mother's Day weekend. I'm Armin Brott. Like their mothers before them, a new generation of moms faces tough choices when it comes to juggling family and career. But unlike their baby boomer mothers, who often had to choose between career and family, these women were raised to believe they could have it all and that they controlled their destiny. Now, after arming themselves with good educations and establishing firm toeholds in the workplace, they've decided to add mother to their resumes. With expectations high, they believe that they will not only manage the demands of career and family, they will excel at it in the same way they've excelled at everything else they've ever tackled. And then, day-to-day reality sets in, and they discover, it's not quite so easy. But today's women are figuring it out by redefining their goals and finding balance in their lives. On today's show, in celebration of Military Spouse Day, which is today, and Mother's Day, which is Sunday, we're going to be exploring the many options that are available to working moms who struggle to forge their own paths professionally and personally. We'll be speaking with the authors of a new book about a unique way of looking at work-life issues. And we'll talk especially about one of their findings, which is that happiness and success often rest in the realization that never enough sometimes has to give way to just plain good enough.
People have all kinds of excuses for not saving energy. I'll turn it off later, so we don't have those Energy Star appliances.
Well, maybe it's time to stop making excuses and save the energy and resources we can.
You just never know what people will need in the future.
We can all help save more energy for tomorrow. What's your excuse? For more energy-saving tips that also save money, visit loseyourexcuse.gov/parents. This message is brought to you by the U.S. Department of Energy, the Ad Council, and this station.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guests for this part of today's show are Becky Beaupré-Gillespie and Holly Schwartz-Temple, who are the co-authors together of Good Enough is the New Perfect, Finding Happiness and Success in Modern Motherhood. Becky and Holly, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
And happy Mother's Day to you.
Thank you.
Let's talk about the whole concept of having it all. That's something that it just seems to go back and forth and back and forth, and sometimes you can't and sometimes you can, and sometimes you have to redefine all so that you can actually have it. And it just seems like that concept right there is at the root of so many problems.
Absolutely. And I think especially for the women of our generation, we are the first generation to reap the full benefits of the women's movement. And I think for both of us and for a lot of our peers, we sort of entered motherhood feeling like we needed to have it all because we had grown up being told you can do anything. And many of us took that to mean you have to do everything.
Well, I was just going to ask you about that, whether you can do anything puts an undue amount of pressure on you that not only can you, not only is it an option, but you have to.
Absolutely. A lot of the women that we interviewed felt very pressured by all the options that they had. But what we found is that the most successful women were willing to sort of take some of that outside pressure, put it to the side, and start picking. They started choosing based on their own priorities. They were told they could do anything, and so they did the things they most wanted to do.
And do you find that they were able somehow, or did they want to combine work and family, or did you find that women kind of gravitated towards more towards one than the other?
Well, we saw a little bit of everything. We did a national survey of more than 900 moms, and what we found was that there were women working in all sorts of shades of gray. So for the previous generation, it was very all or nothing. The baby boomers pretty much worked full-time or didn't work at all. But moms today are finding all sorts of ways to incorporate their professional ambitions and mesh that with the kind of parenting that they want to do. So we talked to moms who worked part-time from home. We talked to moms who took advantage of telecommuting options. We talked to many entrepreneurial moms who started their own ventures in hopes of finding good work-life balance. So we feel that Good Enough is the New Perfect captures this generation of mothers at this moment in time.
Okay. And did you find that a lot of them had noticed differences between their options and their own mother's options, that things had really changed? I mean, you said obviously that the women's movement had changed a lot of things and women have more options, but you know, are people actually aware of that?
I think they are. I think that what they don't have is a manual or a guidebook. And while our book is very narrative and tells a lot of stories, it shows many different ways of getting to that all that each woman has to define for herself. So I think that the stories are getting out there, but it hasn't been discussed enough. The work-life pressures that women today are feeling have not been as much in the public conversation as we think they should be. So we're hoping that's one of the things that will come out of our discussions about this book.
Now, do you think that people have to learn, or I guess not necessarily have to, but it's one of the necessary parts of moving forward as a mother in today's world, that you have to be nice to yourself and lighten up? And I guess that's kind of the concept behind Good Enough being the New Perfect, but that seems like that's an easy thing to say and maybe not such a easy thing to do.
You're absolutely right about that. We found a lot of women who really felt that when they took time for themselves that they were being selfish, because they had these, you know, this long list of all the things they needed to do to qualify as a good mother. And that's something that I think is relatively unique to our generation, new to our generation, is this professionalization of motherhood, where we have these very lofty maternal standards. Part of it is that we have an unprecedented access to information. We've got the internet. We have research studies on infant brain development and on nutrition and on the benefits of organic food, the benefits of being exposed to a foreign language at an early age. And so moms feel like they have a very long list of things that they need to do. And if you're going to try and meet all of those demands, it's very difficult to also fit in there time for yourself. But the most successful women in our survey and the most successful women that we interviewed were very conscious of the need to take care of themselves, not just so they would be more centered and be better mothers and be more functional within their family, but also so they could model this for their children. I find myself as a mother that as hard as it is to sometimes to find the time to, say, go to yoga or to go out with my husband or to go do something for myself, a lot of times I'll think, you know, I want my daughters to grow up believing that this is important. This is something you're allowed to prioritize. This is something you should prioritize, because I certainly hope that they will grow up and be good to themselves.
Now, how hard was this for the women you talked to do? I mean, again, it's a difference between saying and doing. There's so many things that are going on, and particularly if you're a working woman, or working dad for that matter, in a family where you need two incomes and you've kind of gotten yourself into a particular lifestyle that you like, to all of a sudden make changes and to switch to allow yourself the freedom to take yoga in the middle of the day or to do something that, you know, you may have some problems paying a bill if you do that kind of stuff.
Well, it's different for every woman, and I don't think it means that everybody has to do it in the same way. You don't have to go to yoga in the middle of the day to be good to yourself. You don't have to quit your job to make things easier. We found women approaching this in all different ways and in ways that fit their lives. A lot of times it was a matter of really being very conscious in the decisions they did make and thinking really hard about whether they were doing something because they felt obligated to do it or whether they were doing something because it truly fit what their family needed or fit a passion for themselves. One example was volunteering at schools. We heard a lot about that from the moms that we interviewed and even just from the moms that we encounter in our day-to-day life. There were some moms that love helping out in the school, and they have schedules that allow them to do it. But we also encountered a lot of moms who felt that in order to be a good mom, in order to be a good contributor in their child school community, they had to be figuring out some way to fit that field trip or making costumes for the school play into their lives. And it was sometimes things like that that were just sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. And when they really stepped back and said, okay, it's okay for me to say no. It's okay for me to ask for help. And they were able to feel okay about it by reminding themselves that, okay, you know, let's look at the big picture. I might not be able to volunteer at school now, but my schedule is going to ease up next year, and I'll volunteer then. And it was really about examining their individual lives, their individual priorities, and not comparing themselves to other mothers whose lives just weren't the same.
Those two ideas of not comparing yourself and of learning to say no seem to be monumental.
Yes. We're not saying that this is an easy transition, but from our anecdotal evidence, from our personal experience, and from our survey data, we found that the moms who let up on themselves in the areas that they just didn't want to be spending their time on enjoyed much greater overall success. They had better relationships with their spouses. They did not sacrifice in terms of their career advancement. They felt better about taking time for themselves, having passions, having friends, having me time. So good enough is a new perfect is not about settling or aiming lower or some form of mediocrity. Not at all. The moms in our book are undoubtedly successful. They're just doing it on their own terms. And like you said, it's not an easy transition to make, but it's worth the effort.
Becky Beaupre-Gillespie and Holly Schwartz-Temple are the co-authors of Good Enough is the New Perfect, Finding Happiness and Success in Modern Motherhood. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussions with Holly and Becky.
My mom is a hero. She goes into burning buildings. She finds people inside who need to be saved. And then she helps him get out, even when she can't breathe or see, even when she's a little scared. My mom is a firefighter. She does great things. And the best thing she can do is come home.
The U.S. Fire Administration, a part of FEMA, reminds you to protect the heroes who protect our lives. Have a smoke alarm on every floor. Test it monthly. Replace the battery yearly. Do your part to get out before firefighters have to come in. The fact is, 60% of all fire deaths occur in a home without a working smoke alarm. The good news is, that's a fact that can change. For more information, visit the U.S. Fire Administration at www.usfa.fema.gov. Working for a fire-safe America.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. We're continuing our discussion with Becky Beaupre-Gillespie and Holly Schwartz-Temple, who are the co-authors of Good Enough is the New Perfect, Finding Happiness and Success in Modern Motherhood. Want to jump right into some of the other issues that you talk about in the book. Talk about how technology has changed the ability for women to have it all or has increased the amount of pressure on them to do more things in less time.
Absolutely. Technology is both one of our greatest assets and one of our greatest challenges. On one hand, technology has broadened the boundaries in a way few other things have.
By broadened, do you mean eliminated them? Because that's kind of what I find is I work at home a lot of the time, and I there's 2 o'clock in the morning. I get up to go to the bathroom or something. I got to send an email.
Well, in that way, it certainly seems to have eliminated some of the boundaries, but not for everybody. Some people are very good at resetting those boundaries. But what we found is that women have been allowed to do so many more things that have allowed them to have more flexible schedules because of technologies. They can work from home. They can telecommute. And so it seems like it should be nothing but pure upside. And as I think we all know, if we carry an iPhone or a BlackBerry or have an internet account at all, it can be very, very difficult to decide when to stop working. Yes, you can leave work in the middle of the day, but you can also get a call from a client while you're eating dinner. You can also have emails that are coming in at 10, 11 o'clock at night. And a lot of the women that we interviewed described really struggling to set these boundaries, especially early on in their careers before they had really made a name for themselves, before they had really developed the ability to figure out, you know, what was absolutely necessary at that moment and what could wait a few moments.
Well, so what happens? I mean, how does the situation change when these women go beyond their careers and they become parents?
Once they become parents, they a lot of times really began to resent the intrusion, and that's when they had to start setting those boundaries and say, you know what, I am available during the day, but after 6 o'clock at night, I'm on family time. And those women really had to think. They couldn't just say in the back of their heads, okay, I'm going to be better about this. They made some very strategic decisions. One big one was communicating to the people they worked with that these are what my boundaries are. I am not available after 6 o'clock unless it's an emergency, and then they made a specific plan for how somebody could reach them in an emergency, and they defined what an emergency is, what qualifies as an emergency.
One of the things we haven't talked about here is what's going on with the other people in the family, because it's you can't, as a mom or as a daddy, and for that matter, you can't make major changes in your own life without bringing everybody else along. How did you find that women making changes in their lives, did they have a lot of support generally from the husband and kids, or was there some pushback that, hey, you know, we really need you to be doing what you've always been doing here?
Yes, I think that at the beginning stages of any transition, there has to be a conversation within the whole family, and we had experts in our career makeover chapter who talked about that. That it was important for everybody to be on board and to discuss how much control the mom was going to have over her time if she was moving into a new position, how the family juggling might change. For example, when Becky and I were writing this book, we were in a season of work, and so our husbands took on more responsibility than they previously had. They started making the breakfasts and the lunches, so we maybe only had responsibility for the dinners. And there's a constant renegotiation as we move through the seasons of what we're focusing on. The women of our generation do prioritize their marriages. They want equality in their marriages, but they also, if they want to share the joy of parenting, they have to share the power. And that's one of the things we talk about in the book, that if you are going to delegate responsibility to your spouse, it's better if you let your spouse do it on his terms.
Well, it seems like there also might be a little bit of quid pro quo here, because men have historically not, in some ways, had the same sort of workplace flexibility that women have. I think we've kind of looked at work-family issues as women's issues, and guys don't have the same option. So did you find that some of the women that their husbands were saying, hey, you know what, you want flexibility? So do I.
Definitely. I think this generation, the Gen X generation and the millennials, want flexibility in a way that was not possible in the previous generation. And that's why it's so important to talk about it and to get these issues out into the open. Some of the experts that we talked to said until very recently, work-life issues were considered to be private, hush-hush things that the family should consider on their own and deal with. But now that men are becoming a part of the conversation, it really is getting out there. And it's something the whole family needs to discuss, because everybody is affected. And men should have the option to be more flexible, and they can make decisions that will move them in that direction as well. The whole family has to get on board and decide what their priorities are and how they're going to achieve those goals.
What's your best advice for women who are out there listening? And I realize, of course, you can't come up with one thing for everyone, but somebody who's in a situation that she just doesn't necessarily like, she's doing too much, basically, we'll say that she's struggling to have it all, isn't having it all in the way that she'd like. How do you begin the process of, you know, does it start with a family meeting? You know, here's, honey, this isn't working out, or kids as well, and we've got to make some changes, or does it start with an internal dialogue and she comes up with her own list first, or how do you begin the process?
Sure. Well, first of all, I think it depends for each woman or for each family what exactly that process should be. But in general, I think it's important for a woman to examine her attitude, to, for instance, accept that there's a difference between being the best and doing your best, to acknowledge that you can't do everything and be everything, to accept that it is okay to say no, to realize that by dialing back a little bit, if that's what you need to do, that's not saying I'm going to stop short of the finish line. That's saying I'm going to set my own finish line.
Can you give us some specifics? I'd really like to get a sense of how you begin to put these strategies and these ideas into play. What do you do to get things going?
So I think the first part of it is really examining attitude and coming to a peace, to accepting that you don't have to be perfect. And I think for a lot of women, that was a really good starting point because it allowed them to then pave the way for some of this choosing. Sitting down with your spouse and really talking through the big picture. I think one of the things that women tend to do is they look around at other women and say, okay, well, she's working part-time in the same kind of job, and that works well for her. Why doesn't that work for my family? Well, there are a lot of factors that contribute to whether or not something works within a certain family, and it's important to consider how many hours a week does your spouse work? How well do you share household duties and parenting within the house? What are your attitudes about how the children are going to be raised? So I think it starts with an examination of all of these things and really starting to lay out a plan for how you can fit in the things that mean the most to you, the things you're passionate about. Do you love what you're doing? Is there a way that you can focus your work in a way that you're focusing on your passions, on the things mm-hmm. that you most love to do, and still fitting it into the realities of your family life?
Becky Beaupré-Gillespie and Holly Schwartz-Temple are the co-authors of Good Enough is the New Perfect, Finding Happiness and Success in Modern Motherhood. And we do have a couple extra copies of the book. If you would like one, please go to our website, militaryfather.com. Drop us a line from there. Let us know where you're stationed and your address, of course, and we'll get one out to you. Becky and Holly, thanks so much for joining us. Great to have you. And, of course, happy Mother's Day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Salagadoola, Metricaboola, Bibbidi-Bobbidi-Boo.
You must be your fairy godmother. Yes.
It doesn't take a fairy godmother to tell you that the right fit means everything.
Good heavens, child. You can't go in that.
Children under 4'9" need to be in a booster seat because they aren't ready for adult safety belts alone. Many parents miss the important step of booster seats.
Maybe you better explain things to him.
Booster seats raise your child up so that a safety belt designed for adults will fit and protect them properly.
Oh, that does make a difference.
Remember that 4'9" is the magic number. And get your little pumpkin there safely in a booster seat.
Hop in, my dear. Oh, thank you.
And like Cinderella, you can live happily ever after.
It's like a dream. A wonderful dream come true.
For more information, visit boosterseat.gov. This has been a message from the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. Those of you who have been listening to the show for a while probably know that I am a former Marine, to the extent that anybody can actually be a former Marine. So whenever I get an email having anything to do with the military, I want to respond to it right away. Dear Mr. Dad, you've written a lot about dads in the military, but I'm in the opposite situation. My wife is a deployed Marine, and I'm at home with the kids. I'm feeling completely overwhelmed. What can I do to support her and keep myself and the kids sane? First of all, thank you both for your service. With women making up about 11% of deployed service members, you are not alone. Here are a few ideas that may help you. Don't fill your emails or your phone calls with complaints or tell her about problems she can't do anything to resolve. You'll just frustrate her. But don't paint an overly rosy picture either. She'll get suspicious that you're covering something up. Care packages, like treats and reading materials and drawings from the kids, are great. Include a picture of Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, the one before he got fat and became governor of California, but Photoshop your face onto Arnold's neck. I hate to bring up gender stereotypes, but men often do have a harder time asking for help than women. Get over it. Spouses who stay informed and have a solid support network cope better than those who don't. The base family readiness groups, or key volunteer groups, or ombudsman programs, or key spouse programs, that'll depend on what branch of service, will have workshops on various deployment-related issues and social activities for parents and kids. It won't be easy getting welcomed into the network of military wives, but don't give up. You'll eventually be adopted by a group of women, many of whom will insist on mothering you. Enjoy it, but not too much. And while you're reversing stereotypes, bake some cookies for your spouse's group. Keep handy contact names and phone numbers for the family support group and your wife's unit's rear deployment people. Also have a hard copy of her deployment orders and most recent leave and earnings statements. Kids crave routines, so help them and yourself by getting on a schedule. Maybe Tuesday night is Vietnamese takeout. Friday it could be pizza and a movie. Saturdays could be for field trips to museums or parks or zoos or wherever you like to go. And maybe Sunday nights you get yourself a sitter and you go hang out with your buddies. Volunteer at the family support group. Helping other at-home dads will do you and them a world of good. You may also get a line on some terrific babysitters. Help your wife celebrate. There's an excellent chance that she's going to miss some major holidays because of the deployment. So as the big days approach, grab your camera. Take pictures of the kids' special school project. If you're making something at home, film that too. If possible, include the finished product in your next care package along with any holiday-related paraphernalia you can stuff in, like a mini Christmas tree or Hanukkah candles or even a Halloween costume or whatever. In 2008, when Air Force Dr. Ginger Bowles' son was 6 months old, she was deployed to Afghanistan. Not once a little thing like war and 8,000 miles and 10 time zones get in her way, Ginger took along a breast pump. And every other week, she couriered home 30 to 40 pounds of frozen breast milk. Bull's husband then filled the cooler up with goodies and sent it back. Clearly, this approach isn't for everyone, but it just goes to show you how far people will go to stay connected with their family.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
Soon this little baby I'm singing to sleep will start to walk. First, she'll crawl. Then take her first baby steps. Before I know it, I'll be dropping her off at school. I'll be watching her run down a soccer field. Staying up all night waiting for her to get home from her first date. Wincing when she steps on the gas pedal and then the brakes. Beaming when she walks up to accept her diploma. Or holding back tears as she takes those big steps down the aisle. But before she takes all those steps, she and thousands like her will need you to take yours. Gather your family, friends, and co-workers and join March for Babies to help make her steps possible. March for Babies! Start your team today at marchforbabies.org.
Get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Welcome back to the second part of today's Mother's Day show. I'm Armin Brandt.
You know, sending a child off to war has got to be one of the toughest things that a parent can do. The mundane, everyday moments that seem to take on a completely new meaning when your child is gone. Those painful farewells when you don't know that you'll ever see each other again. And then communicating with a child who comes back who's been hardened by combat and is a very different kind of a person. In the second half of the show, we're going to be talking about sending a child off to combat with a woman who's written a wonderful memoir of how difficult it was for her to do exactly that and to communicate with her son. But right now, we're going to bring the battle a little closer to home and a lot lighter, and that's to talk about what happens with a woman who lives in a house full of boys. And to help us with that is Sharon O'Donnell, the author of House of Testosterone, One Mom's Survival in a Household of Males. Sharon, thanks for joining us this morning.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Describe your situation in a household of males. I'm going to have to tell you about my situation, too, in a house full of females, including three female cats.
Oh, my goodness. I have three sons. One is 16, then one's 13, and the youngest is 7. And then, of course, you have to throw my 47-year-old husband in there into that mix also. And we have a male dog who is definitely all male. He gets into the rough housing with the guys. If the guys are wrestling, he starts barking and goes right in there with him. It's almost like it's a second, another brother there. And it's not so much if it's harder to raise boys versus harder to raise girls. There are disadvantages and advantages for both of that. It's just the fact that when you're the only one in the household that is of that gender, it makes it very difficult, particularly when I want to be able to communicate the way women want to communicate. We want to talk. We want to know about details. We want to connect. Guys don't want to do that.
Now, I'm kind of curious about something. I know that it's a nice thing in a way to be a dad in a house full of girls because I get to be the one that they come to when they go through the I hate my mother stage. Do you have a similar kind of thing with boys when they go through a I hate my dad stage, they come to you?
Oh, yes, they definitely do that at some points. And then, of course, if both of us have turned against them, so to speak, then we always hear from the youngest one, the 7-year-old, I want my grandma. So it goes down the chain like that. But, yeah, there's some of that playing one against the other and being able to, I'll step in and maybe comfort them a little bit, the youngest one. And then with the oldest ones, I'll try to see maybe their side of things, too, because they're at the age now, being 13 and 16, that when they have a disagreement with their dad, they might have a valid point, or one that, of course, they think is valid, and they might need a sounding board and maybe a go-between. So, yeah, I sort of run interference quite a bit and try to play a peacemaker role in between, particularly my oldest two boys and my husband.
Now, there's a lot of perception issues, it seems like, between men and women, and we can get into whether that's hardwired or not, but I think a lot of things that women talk about are, how does he not see this, or that kind of thing, and it's got to be magnified by 4 for you.
That's right. Sometimes I feel like I'm talking to 4 brick walls because they just don't seem to connect the dots the way women do when we're talking about certain things. And particularly in talking about finding out about what's happened at a certain event. I remember a number of years ago, my oldest son was in the 7th grade, and I went to pick him up after dance at school. And I was in the carpool line waiting for him to come out. And the car in front of me had a mom in there, too, and her daughters came out and got in the car. And as soon as they got in the car, they started chattering away, getting all those details. That mom was getting all those nice, juicy details about who danced with who and what the decorations looked like and all of that. And my son gets in the car, and I try to ask a question about something, and I get those one-word answers. And eventually I realize this is what my life is going to be. I am the mom of boys. I'm not going to get those details like that.
You know, it seems like there might be an advantage, though, right around prom time where it's probably cheaper. I'm thinking of my daughter gets, one in particular goes to proms. The other one doesn't do it so much. But she gets together with her friends. They come over and they spend hours making up and primping and preening and all this stuff. And they get into the car and I'm driving them over to the prom and I'm marveling at this whole conversation behind me and saying to them, I said, do you realize that all of these boys, there's not one of them who has even thought about what he's going to wear until 5 minutes before he leaves the house.
That's right, and that is an advantage from my standpoint because you do get by with not having to buy a lot of those extras at prom time and a lot of the brand name fashions that are out there that a lot of girls and women tend to feel like they have to buy. So, yeah, that's a definite advantage of having girls. Now, the thing is, on the flip side, my guys, I would like for them to be able to take a little bit more interest in what they're wearing. Not a lot, but a little bit. And particularly with the middle one, making sure he takes a shower when he's supposed to. And so those are the kinds of things that I'm faced with and trying to make sure that the hygiene issue is going to be okay in our household and we don't run all the girls away or anybody away for that matter, because with all the sports and as they get older, yeah, the guys don't smell quite as good as the girls do. Even though the girls might go play sports too, the guys just have that certain something. So when you get back, when they get back and I'm washing the jerseys and having the piles of laundry there, you know, that's when I really go, oh my gosh, it would be a lot easier to wash all those girls' clothes than it would be. Of course, the girls' clothes would be more expensive. So.
Well, right. So how do you manage to find some time for yourself? I'm sort of thinking about, you know, the flip side of it again with my side. I go play softball or hang out with some guys. Is it that easy for you to find time for yourself?
Well, what I like to do, sometimes I go to a movie by myself. More often than not, though, what I like to do is get together with other women, and sometimes they're in the same boat that I am, in a house of testosterone, and we vent, and we say, oh my gosh, can you believe that they didn't understand what I was trying to say to them, or do you believe they totally ignored me? And over time, you kind of come to realize that the guys aren't trying to be rude. It's not an intentional thing on their part. They're just really sincerely oblivious to what's going on, to what you're trying to get across to them. And once you realize that and come to accept it, then it becomes a lot easier to live in that house of testosterone. But, yeah, I do have to get out of the house sometimes.
Do you think that you've had to change your standards, though? Not even had to, but probably done it voluntarily? And I mean, along the lines of what you just said, I mean, understanding that we're just different. And
oh, exactly.
not better or worse, necessarily, but just different.
Sometimes I just have to give up and raise that white flag, because I realize that it's not going to be a battle that I can win, because that's just the way men and women are wired. I mean, there's that research that talks about testosterone in the trimesters of pregnancy, and that what it's doing to those, that wiring on the left and right side of the brain. And so it's not just saying, oh, well, it's testosterone and it's a lucky guess or it's some type of hypothesis. It really does have that scientific background behind it to say, yeah, guys are different. They do communicate differently. And so why try to be up against it all the time? Try to laugh about it when you can, which is why I wrote the book.
You know, years ago when my kids were much smaller, we would go up and visit a cousin of mine who's got all boys. And she, I think, had the most heavy-duty case of boy or girl envy. It was really kind of an amazing thing. I mean, she wanted to take my daughters and paint their nails and go out and do girl things and buy pink things and stuff like that. Do you ever have kind of girl envy?
Right. Well, sometimes I do. I have a sister. One sister has three boys, and the other sister has a boy and a girl. And the girl got married about a year and a half ago. And watching her come down the aisle, I'm thinking, I'm never really going to have that. I will with my sons, probably, but I'm never going to have that bride coming down the aisle, mother of the bride kind of thing that you hear so often. But more so than just thinking about painting the nails or buying something pink, I think it's more of when those boys get older and you don't have that girl, because that old saying about a daughter's a daughter all of her life, but a son's a son until he takes a wife or whatever that is, it really is in the back of our minds as moms of boys. And we're thinking about that as we're raising them and making sure that, hey, we want to make sure that bond stays very strong too, just like that mother-daughter bond you hear so much about. Of course, it doesn't happen all the time with mothers and daughters, but still you want to make sure it happens with your son too.
So what's the guy zone that you talk about?
Well, the twilight zone, of course, is when they're out somewhere in that you can't be reached, out in outer space somewhere. The guy zone is similar to that. They're not in outer space. They're right here in the house, but I cannot reach them because I can't seem to get through to them. They can't remember anything, particularly my husband. And as the guys get older, as my 16-year-old has grown from a boy to a guy, I really see that more in him. And as I said, particularly my husband, and being able to have him remember something and 5 minutes later not ask the question that we just talked about 5 minutes earlier, and then not remember that conversation. Sometimes that happens, and you really begin to question your own sanity and say, now I know I just talked about that. It used to be my oldest son would be a witness to those conversations between my husband and myself and be able to say, oh, yeah, Dad, she told you that. But if he becomes a guy, I have the same problem with him.
So that How guy's old are they now?
He'll be 17 in July.
Okay.
So he's 6'5", and then I have my 13-year-old, and then I have the 7-year-old. So I'm starting all over, so to speak, with my 7-year-old, but it gives me a good perspective. I realize that my 7-year-old is going to be 6'5", or over 6 feet tall very quickly, and I need to make sure I savor those moments as he's growing up, because it really does go by very quickly. You know, a lot of times you don't think about, when people say that to you, that it's true. But it definitely is. It does go by very quickly.
So do you feel that you've missed out on something, being the mother of only boys?
I think I probably have, but I don't think it's anything that I'm going to worry about or regret. I think the main thing is, again, looking forward to the future and making sure that I cultivate those relationships with those future daughters-in-law so that I'll still have that good relationship with my son, even after he might get married, and then, of course, the grandkids and all of that. But I do. There are times I really like to go to plays, the theater. And even though my guys will go occasionally, it's not their thing, whereas I know some women that have girls that go on these weekends to New York or go downtown to the local play, and they all look forward to that, whereas with my guys, they might go, but they're not going to be going willingly sometimes, or they're not going to be going with that excited spirit in them like most of the girls have. And I miss out on sharing some of those things with a daughter, I think. But that's a very small thing in the big picture when you look at the whole thing. And the main thing is just making sure as they get older that bond continues to grow.
Sharon O'Donnell, the author of House of Testosterone, One Mom's Survival in a Household of Males. Happy Mother's Day. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. And same thing to your wife.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to take a look at a completely different kind of mother-son relationship, in particular, how it is that you go about sending a child off to war. So stay with us. I'm Armin Brott, and you're listening to Positive Parenting.
Hey, Dad.
What?
I can't get the ketchup bottle open.
Here, let me try. Yeah, it's stuck all right.
Anything?
Now watch. If you take your palm like this and smack it on the bottom right here, you can get it open pretty easily. Here you go.
Thanks.
You don't have to be a hero to be a hero. When you adopt a child from foster care, just being there makes all the difference. To find out how you can adopt, please visit our website at AdoptUSKids.org or call 1-888-200-4005. A public service announcement brought to you by Adopt US Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for the rest of today's show is Frances Ritchie, who's the author of The Warrior, A Mother's Story of a Son at War. Frances, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, this is a tough thing. You've been through something that a lot of people have not been through, and that most of the people who've been through it kind of wish that they hadn't, and that's sending a child off to war. Tell us a little bit about how the whole process started, because it sounds like you were maybe surprised by your son going into the military in the first place.
Well, it's funny. I wasn't surprised. I just wasn't very happy about it in the beginning because I grew up in the 60s, and so the only thing I had in my mind was the Vietnam War. But my son, as a teenager, told me that he wanted to go to West Point. And his grandfather on his father's side had wanted to go to West Point and ended up not being able to go. And he has an uncle on my side of the family who was a West Point grad. So he had been up to West Point as a youngster when he was like 11 or 12 and fell in love with the place. So to be honest, I wasn't surprised. But he did graduate from West Point in 1998 when we were not at war. 9/11 was a terrible shock to all of us, and I live in Manhattan, and so I was here. And I knew that day that Ben would go to war. He had actually started his first day of Special Forces training that day.
Wow.
So he was unreachable for, I think it was 6 weeks. He had just started what they call the Q course, the qualification course.
And but he was
so
also...
It was that moment, 9/11, when I knew that he would go to war.
He was also unreachable, though, moving out a couple of years now, because he would go off, he was a Green Beret, he would go off on these secret missions. And you just never hear from him. That's got to be the hardest thing. I mean, you're turning on the television hoping that you don't see his picture in the wrong kind of context.
Right. Well, that's true. And that's true. It was very frightening. He went to Iraq the first time right at the end of the year in 2004. And he was there for, I think it was 8 months. And that was very hard. It sounds strange, but I actually did watch TV all the time, and I read the paper and all the magazines, and basically just watched, tried to stay connected to the news that way, because I couldn't be with him, I couldn't protect him, but somehow I didn't want to turn away from this thing that was happening over there that he was experiencing.
Now, I should tell people that the book is in poetry, which is another, it's kind of a nice way of reading about these kinds of things. And you said in some ways that it was easier to communicate with your son through poetry than it was to actually sit down and have conversations with him. How did that work?
Well, that's true, because my son and I didn't agree on a lot of things. I thought that we should not go into Iraq, and he felt not only that we should go, but that it was his duty to go, that this was his commitment, and so it was very hard, because he knew how I felt, and so there was some strain in our relationship. And when I was writing the poems, I was able to say things that are hard to say to a person face to face. You know, to say to your son before he goes to war, "I'm afraid you're never going to come home, and I'm terrified, and I'm going to be anguished." That's the last thing you want to say to a person who has to go into battle. They've got to be focused on what they're doing and not worrying about you. So through the poems, I was able to say those things in images and in stories, and in bringing up memories of him when he was little and as he was growing up, and just sort of keeping those memories alive on the page. And then when he came home, and he had a chance to, you know, unwind from combat, then I could show him the poems, and I didn't have to tell him what it was like to wait for him. He could read it, but he could read it in a way that was easier to hear and to listen to. And
right.
We talked about the poems, and it actually did heal our relationship in a beautiful way.
Frances, would you read one?
Sure. Do you have a preference?
Yeah, there was one actually in particular that seemed to be very topical. It's on page 11, Letters, and it's number 2, about last Mother's Day.
Sure. Last Mother's Day, when he was incommunicado, nothing came. 3 days later, a message in my box, a package. The mailroom closed. I went out into the lobby, banged my fist against the desk. When they gave it to me, I clutched it to my chest, sobbing like an animal. I spoke to no one, did not apologize. I didn't care about the gift. It was the note I wanted, the salt from his hand, the words.
That's very powerful stuff. Tell us a little bit more about the conflict between you and the political views, because I'm curious, were you able to, being a child of the 60s, to get past the against the war and to separate out the supporting your son and not supporting the war? Was that something that you felt you could eventually do at some point?
Boy, that's such a great question, because, you know, it sounds so easy to say I'm against the war and I support the troops, but actually living it is something completely different. And I have to say that because I knew that Ben had so much integrity from the time he was a little boy, and when he went to West Point, honor and duty really meant something to him. So I knew that he believed in what he was doing. And when he came home the first time after his first tour of duty, he was in so much pain, all physical pain, emotional pain. And I realized that politics wasn't important, that, you know, our arguing about whether this was the right policy or not was just the last thing in the world that I wanted to spend time on. And so I made a conscious decision to really try to see things from his point of view. I mean, I knew that I wasn't going to become a conservative, but I also knew that he was a good person, and that and that we were never going to come back together in a good relationship if I didn't start trying to at least listen to him and see his point of view without, you know, trying to argue with him about it. And so that's what I did.
Was this something that you set out about, you thought you would write a book that would be for public consumption, or were you really writing this as personal notes to yourself and to him to kind of memorialize this whole thing?
Well, it was, you know, when I was writing the poems, I carried them in a notebook, and some of them did get published. So I was sending some of them out for publication. But it was also a way of keeping a diary. And I'm in a little writing group, and I used to take my journal to our group instead of poems and read the raw journal entries to this small group of friends and cry while I was reading them. And then later on, they became poems. And I carried that notebook around with those poems in it because it was a way to feel close to him when I couldn't actually, you know, protect him or be with him.
Did you ever have a chance to meet with other military mothers, people who were perhaps not as fortunate as you are to have your son come back alive?
You know, it's so ironic. During the years that he was deployed and in dangerous circumstances, I didn't know any military moms. All my friends in the city are not military. But now that these poems have gone out into the world, I am hearing from military moms every day, and mainly moms whose sons are deployed and who are afraid. And who've been through exactly the same things I've been through. And it just touches my heart when I get their emails. And so I try to at least provide answers on the blog if I can't answer everything that comes in. But it does make me feel like really part of a community of women who have loved ones in dangerous circumstances and who want to support them.
You know, I'm just starting to think about my own mother now. I joined the Marines years and years ago when I was 17.
Oh, my goodness.
But I was in a very different circumstance. There was no impending war. It was after Vietnam and before everything else.
Okay.
And so, but I remember her crying as I left. And it never occurred to me, actually, to ask her what she was going through at that point, because she probably had a lot of the same sorts of worries and feelings that you did, even though there wasn't a war happening right then.
Well, you know, what I would say to you as her son is that not asking her was probably the best thing that you could do, because when you do leave, whether you're going directly into combat or not, it's, you know, you just have to be focused. And that's what I realized about my son. He was responsible for his men and for his mission, and you were probably responsible for certain things. And, you know, if you turn around and start, you know, crying with your mom, it's going to be hard to get on that plane and go do what you have to do. And by the same token, I can so open my heart to your mother, because I'm sure she was terrified for you.
Frances, read one more for us.
I'll read you a poem called Collisions. I actually gave this to Ben for his birthday. Ben loves the Rose Center. He loves the planetarium. And when he was in Iraq, I used to go to the planetarium here in the city and by myself and sort of sit in those stars. And that was a way to sort of feel like I could be with him. So this poem is called Collisions, to my son in Iraq. There's a new space show at the Rose Center. It's all about collisions. How one little particle or cosmic rock thrown off course can make a moon or tilt a planet into life. And though I felt comforted among the stars you love, I'm beginning to accept we're never safe. The universe always in motion. Even when we sleep, particles making and remaking our bodies. The world between us a fire that burns away the planks of the heart. I don't know how they calibrated those holographic comets and asteroids with the thunder of impact, each explosion just bearable. I tensed up anyway, as I do when cars and trucks blow up on the news. I almost closed my eyes, but I could feel you in the empty seat beside me shake your head and say, "You're too timid," the way you did when you were 12, and I was afraid to open the door I'd forgotten to lock. You went in ahead of me.
Frances Ritchie, the author of The Warrior, A Mother's Story of a Son at War. Frances, thanks for joining us, and happy Mother's Day.
Thanks so much, Armin.
And Mom, happy Mother's Day to you, too.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.